Welcome to the Mastering Therapy podcast with me, Dr. Natalie Stock, clinical psychologist. This is a show for psychologists, psychotherapists, and counsellors who are looking to build on their therapy skills, increase confidence in working with clients, and be inspired by alternative models, tools, and ways of working. Join my guests and me as we learn from one another and aim to take insights and put them into action. This episode is a fantastic introduction to transactional analysis. I have with me Dr. Tracy King, a clinical psychologist, expert and trainer in transactional analysis. What you can expect from this episode is not just an overview. Tracy goes into some of the terminology that's associated with TA, like ego states, life scripts, injunctions. Tracy helps us think about how we can help clients to understand the patterns that they're operating in. It's a really great one for providing you with an extra tool that you might be able to use to maybe map a client's interactions onto it. The versatile thing about transactional analysis is that you can use it alongside other therapeutic approaches. And I've always been curious as to whether the drama triangle links directly to TA. So I asked Tracy about that at the end. If after listening to this, you think you might like extra training in it, definitely check out Tracy's website. Enjoy. Tracy, do you want to share who you are and how you came to work using transactional analysis, which is what we're going to be talking about today?
Well, before I was a clinical psychologist, I did a diploma in counselling, and that had a little bit of transactional analysis in it, which I'm going to refer to as TA as we go through, so that just makes it easier to say. I then went on to obviously do a doctorate in clinical psychology. So I did my degree, I did a master's in forensics, and I did a doctorate in clinical. And then I went back and did a 4-year training in transactional analysis, which actually for me ended up being a 5-year training because I had a baby in between and went back and repeated my foundation year. So I've been immersed in it for a very long time. A lot of my supervision, even before doing the training, had a TA hat on it. And in fact, I'm just thinking, even before I was a clinical psychologist or doing counselling, I worked in a blue chip corporate company whereby we did a lot of internal communications and more organisational psychology. And we used to use the theory of drivers, which I'll say a bit more about later, to map teams and how teams interacted with each other. So that was when I probably first came across it. So literally probably 30 odd years ago.
My bet is that most people won't be as familiar with TA as the models, and so it would be really good for you to give us a bit of an overview as to what TA is. Yeah. If my memory serves me correctly, I think we had a half day or a day training on it on my clinical training, but it's not something that a lot of psychologists are familiar with. Maybe it's taught more in counselling settings. I'm not sure. Would you mind just explaining it? Because I think it's something that we could use in our work with people. And I think you explained it really lovely as a framework in which you can then add other interventions to. So TA, what is it? And when might you use it?
Eric Byrne was the psychiatrist that he was the founder of TA in the 1950s. And it's essentially, it's a personality theory. So it's a way of understanding the self. And it does map onto lots and lots of other theories. But what I see it as is, for me, it feels like it's a catch-all framework, like I was saying before, that we can maybe formulate a client that we've got, understand where they're coming into therapy, where they're at, and then put other interventions on top of it. And a lot of the interventions in TA also map to other things. So for example, there's something called the racket system in TA, which is very much like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. It looks a lot at what people's thoughts, feelings and behaviours are, and it looks at what has triggered somebody to have a disproportionate emotional reaction to an event, and then it helps them to look at their core beliefs underneath that and work through those. So it's not something that is alien to the things that we might be more familiar with in clinical training. So again, psychodynamic approaches, attachment theory, looking at someone's early life, that's what TA does as well. It's looking at the family of origin we've been born into, how have we coped in that, what decisions have we had to make in order to survive that environment? So making that a bit more concrete. When we were born, if we were born into a family that didn't particularly like to express their emotions, we soon have to learn, oh, I'm going to actually hold back. I'm not going to cry because when I cry, nobody really comes or people might be critical to me. So we then make a decision of, okay, in this world, it seems that if I actually express myself, no one's going to respond. So I'm making a life decision of do not feel, which in TA terms is called an injunction. In CBT, we might look at that as a core belief perhaps, or a negative thought, depending at what level it is for someone. But there are a lot of similarities that we can use TA to sort of map onto things we might do next. And I think the difference of TA to all of these separate different interventions that we may have learned is it's a very kind of user-friendly, easy way of transparently explaining to clients what we're doing. And I found that when I work with it, because there's a lot of diagrammatic things that we could use, so again, maybe mapping onto what we might know with CBT, where we can give things to clients to learn about why they are doing what they're doing, so that they can then take that away and self-generate their own self-reflection and understand how they're operating, why they're responding to things in certain ways, and what their life script is on the basis of what they've experienced in their early life. So it's a bit narrative really, because we're trying to map for someone, what are those early decisions? How have you then replayed those over and over again in your life? And which bits of that are working for you and which bits are not working for you? And how would you like to do it differently? So you're rewriting the narrative essentially, which again is maybe a bit like cognitive analytic therapy where you reformulate with someone. So there's lots of kind of, I guess, crossovers really.
And these are unconscious choices people are making early on, right? You said how someone might decide if emotion isn't encouraged and celebrated, then I'm going to withdraw. These are then unconscious rules that we live by and then grow up with. And I guess the process of working with someone in this way would be to make those unconscious choices conscious and then to help someone rewrite that decision or rethink about how they're going to respond.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And the diagrammatic way of representing that, which I think some people might have come across even if they haven't understood or thought about how to use, is the one of ego states. So the ego state is this kind of thoughts, feelings, behaviours, experiences that we've had that contributes to certain ways that we interact with ourselves, the world and others. So in TA terms, there's something called a parent ego state, which includes things from our parents or our caregivers, but not only them, it's any figure of authority. So one of the questions that can often be asked is, what if someone doesn't have a parent, for example? Do they develop a parent ego state? So that can come from extended family, that can come from teachers, from older siblings, particularly if there's been a dynamic where one sibling has been in more of a parentified role where they're caring for the others. So then that sibling will contribute to that individual's parent ego state because they've been seen as more of an authority figure. Similarly, at a different level, there's the culture that will go into your parent ego state. So it's kind of the rules, like you said earlier, it's the shoulds, the musts that we develop from our life experiences that we might have. So if you think of that at a higher level, that can be cultural. It's like, how do we respond? What is acceptable in this society and in my tribe, essentially? It's quite primitive. And within that parent ego state, we can have a nurturing parent that is attuned and is responding to us in a way that meets our needs. Or we can have a critical parent that is maybe saying to us, you should do this. It might be shaming us. They might be saying to us, I'm only going to love you if you do well in your exam. So there's conditions of achievement, etc., that are put on them from parents. And within that process, we develop what is called injunctions, which are ways of understanding the self, the world and others. So the one we've been talking about so far is the do not feel injunction. Another one is something called a do not exist injunction. So this might be for a child that has maybe experienced neglect or has not been responded to consistently, is completely ignored, and they just feel like they shouldn't be there. A client that I actually had a while back, she had an experience whereby she was told by her mother that she didn't want her and that she tried to abort her. So it's a very strong do not exist injunction, which thinking as a clinician, very often I find that injunction one of the most stark ones, because very often in terms of transference and the relational response that you might have to a client, people with do not exist injunctions are often the ones where I'll muck up the appointment, or I'll lose the file, or I'll do something wrong with the notes. Like something goes wrong, I forget something or something happens, and that will happen two or three times with clients that have a do not exist injunction. And although these things are not diagnostic, you're not instantly thinking, oh, right, that's definitely it. That allows you to sort of keep that in mind when you have that. Or similarly, when you watch somebody that is saying, oh, I'm thinking a lot and talking about what they think and not ever saying I feel, you might start to think, oh, okay, I wonder if there's a do not feel injunction. There's other ways in other therapeutic approaches that we might think the same things, but this enables us to understand a little bit about what someone's parental growing up experience might have been from the language that they're using and from our own transferential responses to them in the parent ego state.
So I guess you'd explain this with a client, you'd talk them through what the parent ego state was. And I'm wondering, how would you then identify with them? Would you be asking them about their early childhood experiences? How were you parented? How were you disciplined? And would that be a process of, are you writing it out? Is the client writing it out?
Yes, as anything, there's different ways of doing it. So in your initial intake assessment, you'd just do what you would ordinarily do as any clinician. You get a bit of a history about the person. But with TA, you are looking for their experiences of being parented and their early life. So you're asking them to say things like, what happened when you fell over? Did somebody come to you and explain that that's okay to be hurt? Did somebody say, get up and get on with it? Or how were you responded to? Similarly, like you say, how were you disciplined? What was your relationship with your mum, with your dad? Were they around? Would you go to them with difficulties? So you start to get a sense of what their experience is. Now, one of the things I know that you raised with me beforehand is, what if someone just hasn't had a parent present? Sometimes that can very much link into the do not exist injunction, like there isn't a sense of who they are because of that, and they might have had multiple people caring for them, so they might have a very fragmented and confused sense of what their parent ego state is. So they might have some people that criticize, they might have some people that were nurturing, then they might have had more criticism, and that can end up with them feeling quite confused as to what the parent ego state is. Essentially, difficult childhood.
Some people might have positive memories of early childhood, but they might have a sense that things have gone wrong at some point, or that, well, I've got this odd memory of holiday and that was positive, but I know there was a lot of...
Have you ever been curious about using AI to do your note-taking after your therapy sessions? The admin juggle is real. Using AI to transcribe my notes has quite literally changed my practice forever.
I'm going to be running a 70-minute webinar that you can join live and you can have access to after and watch as many times as you would like. I'm running this on Friday, the 25th of April, 2025. So put the date in your diary. This is a step-by-step guide on how to use Heidi Health, the note-taking AI software for therapists. If you're curious about how it works, including concerns around consent and GDPR, or if you're already using it and want to ensure that you're maximising the features, then this webinar is for you. Join me and sign up at masteringtherapy.com or click the link in the show notes.
Stuff that was going on and I just can't remember it. So
absolutely.
What would you say to somebody that brings that struggles to identify the negatives, or that feels like they don't have any memories?
One of the ways of thinking about it backwards, if somebody doesn't have a memory of childhood, which lots of people don't, and in terms of trauma won't if they've had quite a traumatic...
Yeah.
So you might get somebody sitting before you sort of saying, I've never felt good enough, or the self-criticism, so the inner critic that they're presenting with you in the room, that is their parent ego state, but they might not know what it maps onto in terms of the content. And in a way, it doesn't matter hugely if you're working with it, aside from allowing someone to understand transparently that that's where that's coming from. So that voice that's criticizing them isn't necessarily their voice. It's coming from someone else. It's coming from experiences that they've had, that they've had to learn to develop that self-criticism as a way to adapt and survive the environment and the experiences that they've had.
Yeah, okay. And with the parent ego state, am I right in thinking it's not just necessarily negative? It can be positive messages that were received in childhood? Because what you're essentially saying is that those early messages that were received, we carry through with us to adulthood, and then it's those that play out in our interactions, either with others or to ourselves. Yes.
Absolutely. And I mean, essentially, we can have something called a winning script, which is when we have had the most positive impact from our parents or our caregivers. And if we think of attachment theory, that's going to map on to secure attachment. So there's been an attuned parenting experience there. Whereas if there's more of a critical response from someone, that's going to be much more of an insecure attachment, whatever type that ends up being.
And how do people find that process of identifying that? I'm imagining for some people it's quite a painful thing to have to go through those moments where they felt like they didn't exist. Or the other thing that comes up is people can feel quite guilty if maybe they had a hard upbringing, but as adults have overcome some of those challenges and maybe have quite a positive relationship with their parents now. When you're then going back on all the difficult part of that, how do you navigate that with someone and encourage them to stick with it?
Yeah, again, it's about sharing a little bit of theory with them. So with this parent, adult, child, we haven't spoken about the adult and child yet, we're sort of stuck in parent at the moment. But with a parent ego state, with what you're internalizing from your parent, they've internalized from their parent, and it goes through generationally. So again, like we might talk about transgenerational attachment types, the messages, the injunctions, the things that we're going to be responding to have come from their experience of caregivers, culture, etc. So by using that, we're essentially again taking a bit more of a narrative approach where we're externalizing blame and saying this happened to person A, this is how they understood the self, the world and others, this is how they're interacting with person B, which is the client, and this is the impact on you. And we're looking to understand the impacts of things, not necessarily blame or judge anyone for that, but understand that the way anyone responds initially is a survival adaptation. It's the best way possible. We know how to do something with the resources we've got at that time.
Okay, great. So once you've kind of established the parent state, do you want to say a little bit about the child state?
Yeah, so the child state is kind of our emotions and our sense of how we would respond as children. So within that, we have free child, which is creative, spontaneous. It's that sort of playful child that will pull faces at people, will dance, will sing, will jump in puddles, do all the fun stuff. And then there's what's called an adapted child, which is when we make those life decisions that we change our behaviours in order to feel that we are loved, cared for, and that we will survive in that environment. So an adapted child, again, might be a child that chooses to suppress emotion, or it might be a child that notices, oh, when I get an A on my test results, my parents love me, they think that's great. They're not so happy when I get a B. So you might get somebody that then decides to make an adaptation and always push themselves to achieve something or do something for somebody, essentially. And similarly, they might be then deciding to be people pleasers, where they look after someone else's emotions and suppress their own as a result of those decisions. Whereas again, in a more of a secure attachment position, a child may be free to be creative and to follow their passions and ask for their needs to be met, because there has been that attunement.
Okay. And with the child state, can there be both those negative responses and the positive ones? So if somebody says, as a child, I was really creative, I was really free, I was always very confident, they might be recognising themselves very differently now in comparison to when they were a child. Or say if somebody as an adult is very withdrawn, very self-deprecating, fairly insecure, worried about what other people think of them. Is it common that that experience would have started in childhood, or do you see it that as a child, well, I was always volunteering, I was up on the stage performing, I didn't mind what people thought? Is there ever that discrepancy?
I mean, I think there can be. It's not necessarily always from childhood, but it wouldn't necessarily be a part of their full child ego state then. So somebody, for example, could have had a major loss or a trauma later in life that's then causing that withdrawal that isn't mapping on to their core sense of who they are that was there before that particular precipitating incident. So sometimes when we're talking about what we were saying earlier about sometimes we map it back. It's again about almost getting a timeline of when did this emerge? Is this a part of who you are as your core, your personality, and how you see the world, yourself and others? Or has something happened that has shifted that, but it's not necessarily you at your core, it's how you're feeling currently, and is more of a mental health response perhaps to something. And that's important to sort of pull out as well. Going back to what you said about maybe the questions to ask, to try and elicit if somebody's got a parent ego state at play, you might want to say to somebody, whose voice is that? Whose rule is that? Who is that that you hear saying that? Or who do you imagine it might be? Asking them, where do you think that's come from? Sometimes they'll know, sometimes they won't, and that's okay too. And similarly with a child ego state, when someone's having a response, it's about maybe saying to them, how old do you feel right now? It's a really simple question, but it can sometimes really orient someone back to where they were and where that came from. And sometimes they answer really super quick, and it is quite an unconscious response. As a clinician, the kind of markers are very often language and body language. So if someone's in a parental state, you might be seeing them either being quite nurturing and saying to you, oh, but are you okay? If you've had a cold or something, you was off the week before, they might be saying, are you sure you're okay to come back today? And they're trying to sort of put your needs before their own. Or they might be talking about how they criticise someone else or criticise themselves by thinking, I should have done this differently. And then you know that a parent ego state is at play somewhere in there. If they're being quite playful, or they sometimes look quite childish, so you might get someone that's maybe swinging their legs a bit in the chair, that's looking a bit more like there's a lot more movement and there's a lot more freedom in them, which can sometimes indicate that they're in a child ego state. And that might be the time to say, oh, how old do you feel right now? I think, though, rather than just popping that in there without any context, you have to have said a little bit about the framework within which you're working, because sometimes that kind of question can make people think, well, why are you asking me that? I'm an adult. Why are you asking me how old I am? So there has to be some contextualization there. But sometimes those are the ways that we can get in, by just asking really simple questions when we observe certain behaviours or certain ways of speaking.
Yeah. And when you're drawing this out, are you doing it in like a triangle? Do you use a triangle to map this out? I'm just thinking about the drama triangle, but I'm wondering if this is it similar to that?
It's a separate thing. We can come on to the drama triangle in a little bit, but with an ego, it's called an egogram, basically, the way that we map whether somebody is in parent, adult or child. So we've spoken about parent and child. If I just quickly say with adult, about the here and now. So if we're in parent and child, we're being reactive, we're not responding, we're reacting to things that have come from the past. So the response we're having is disproportionate to the current stimuli that we're experiencing. So a classic example might be somebody coming home from work and shouting at a partner because they feel that they're not good enough, but actually that's mapping onto some early child experiences of their feelings not being heard, and some early parent ego states of them being told they have to perform and they have to do things in a certain way. But the response to the partner of them maybe being home late, for example, and shouting is very disproportionate. So it's reactive. It's not a response in the moment. Whereas if we're in adults, we're very present, we're responding to someone, and we're not having those reactions that are coming from past emotional salience.
Okay. With the adult state, is this something that you're inviting the client to think about, giving you examples of when they're at their best version of themselves and when they're communicating in a way that feels most like authentic to them? Or does the adult state look the same for everybody?
No, it can be very different for people. I mean, there is a similarity in that we're not being reactive and we're not being influenced by past experiences when we respond to someone in a reactive way. We can respond and be aware of past experiences, but we're not reacting and being, I guess if we bring polyvagal theory in here, we're not being dysregulated in terms of going into fight or flight or a shutdown position. We're actually connecting in our sort of ventral vagal system, and we're able to socially connect and be present with someone. And that's the adult ego state. And part of TA therapy, and I think any therapy really, is about helping people to have that emotional regulation, be responding in the present and be authentic to themselves and be able to ask for their needs to be met and for that to be reciprocated.
Yeah. Okay. So once you've drawn this out with someone and you've got a good understanding of each of their ego states, are you then exploring how they interact with one another? One of the fascinating things that I think you just touched on is that there's almost the social script. So if you look at an interaction, what example did you give? Someone comes home from work and they say that they're not good enough.
They sort of overreact to say somebody saying, "Oh, you're late home." They might overreact and shout and say, "Nothing's ever good enough. I'm not good enough." Those kinds of stories. Yeah.
My understanding is that actually sometimes we can say the right thing. So the response, if we were to write it or read it out on paper, the response might be an adult response. So, "Oh, you're late home." The response might be, "Yes, I'm sorry that I'm late home." But if the emotional experience of that, so depending on the tone it was said in, if it was "Oh, for goodness sake, you're late home," that is then perceived as really critical. So actually on paper it looks like maybe they were in adult state, but it might be critical parent that was coming out, and that is what's responded to. Because I think a lot of people get in loops where, "Well, I said the right thing," and actually this isn't about saying the right thing, it's about how the interaction was experienced by that individual. Have I got that right?
Yeah, absolutely. What you're picking up on is, if we sort of think of parent, adult, child visually, you've got the P, the A and the C sort of in a line. And if we talk to someone else, we can have what's called complementary transactions, where our adult might go to their adult. We could even have a P going to a P and that being acceptable, where someone's saying, "Oh, I think we should always pay our bills on time." And the other person goes, "Yeah, I think we should always do that as well," which is essentially potentially coming from a parent ego state because it's a rule that's been set up. But it works because you're both in the same place. Similarly, with child to child, you might have somebody say, "Oh, come on, let's like run and jump in these puddles like we used to when we were younger," and really access that. And then the other partner wants to do that too. Or we could have something called a contradictory, sort of an ulterior transaction, where it looks like it's adult to adult, exactly as you've said, but it might be parent to child, where someone says, "Oh, I'm always left to do everything on my own when you don't come home on time." And it could be that they're then, what you're saying is that drama triangle then, which maps onto parent, adult, child, is that somebody is then engaging in what's called an ulterior transaction, because it seems adult to adult and in the moment. But what's happening is they're coming from more of a victim position where they don't feel that their needs are met. And they're almost in this child ego state where they're saying to somebody, help me, I need you to parent me or be adult with me or do something with me. And the other person just can't meet that transaction because it's just not clear what they mean when they're saying it. It's not a direct communication.
Right. Because a lot of clients, when they're coming, because this stuff is so unconscious, they might find it quite hard to identify, "Oh, this is me in child," because their narrative might be, "This is me trying to get my needs met." But I guess what we're saying is, well, that need might be valid. It might cost you a lot. It might impact the family a lot if you're always late. But the way it's being communicated is what's getting you stuck here. And so we need to learn a different way of communicating.
Absolutely. Eric Byrne spoke about the games we play, and these are kind of psychological patterns of interaction and communication that we replay over and over again that keep us exactly stuck. So the idea is that if in childhood we didn't have our needs met and we made a life script decision of "No one's going to be there for me, no one's going to meet my needs," our communication patterns as we get into adult relationships are going to be very similar to the one we've just said, where someone might say, take that victim position and say, "Oh, for goodness sake, you're never here for me. I always have to do everything on my own. Why are you late all the time?" Rather than saying to someone directly, "Have you got time to talk? When can we sit down and talk? When do you feel able to go through some things that I just want to talk about that's happening in our relationship?" And being very current and in the here and now, because the person is being reactive and dysregulated because their needs haven't been met, and they're displaying it through tone and maybe behaviour with that person rather than that direct adult to adult communication. And with the mapping of egograms, you're quite right, nobody's going to know where they're at initially, and it's kind of like a learning process that a lot of psychoeducation is done around. But when they can then map and see the shifts in themselves, they can then notice the shifts in other people as well and start to be able to map that too, and then moderate their behaviour and understand themselves and be a bit more compassionate to the self, because they realise it's unconscious things that are contributing to the way that they're reacting rather than responding to things.
What I think so fascinating at TA is that it is about switching roles. And so if you can observe what's happening, you can be quite intentional about responding differently. And the idea is that, so say if you've got critical parent, but you respond as adult, it then is more likely to put that individual into responding as adult. They can reciprocate that.
Yes, again, I always say to people, we can't 100% guarantee anyone's going to move and shift, because that's all their stuff that we're not in control of. But yeah, if you stay an adult, you've got the best chance possible of the other person responding differently. But you've also got 100% chance of you staying regulated if you can help yourself stay in adult, which, how do we do that? That's through lots of other techniques. So that's about nervous system regulation. That's about understanding different ways of responding. It's about learning to moderate the way that you speak and knowing why you're doing something. Because what you ultimately want when you're being reactive, what we all want, is to get our needs met in some shape or form. So this is allowing somebody to almost take a breath, take a step back and think, well, that's what the end result that I want, but I'm not getting it the way I've always been doing it. So now I'm going to try it this way. And obviously there's a lot of back work that's been done to help somebody get to that point. It's not a sudden thing.
You can see how things like ACT or CFT fit really nicely into this. You know, learning a compassionate voice or being aware of a compassionate nurturer and being able to channel that towards yourself. So yeah, do you find that you we'll begin with this as a framework and then you'll use other modalities to help someone boost their soothing system or the way that they see themselves, so it's maybe less critical and more compassionate?
Yes. Just sticking with the ACT idea, what we're essentially doing with ego states is, in pure TA terms, we're looking to decontaminate the adult ego state from parent and child. So we're just in the present, in the moment. So that maps very nicely onto ACT in terms of present moment, mindfulness focus, and also the diffusion from your thoughts. And it's almost like we're running a program in TA idea. You know, the thoughts, the words, the senses are just coming out. But that's not really who we are. So part of TA is about sort of stripping back the layers of the onion to reach somebody's authentic self, which is, if we think of other ideas, like humanistic ideas are about self-actualization. I do Jungian coaching as well. So that's about individuation. It's coming back to what is that core authentic person after all the conditioning, when we take all of those layers back, and then they build who they want to be. And they might want to have consciously some of the rules that their parents had, some of the ones that work well for them. They might want to keep those, but then they're doing it with awareness rather than it being something that's just coming up unconsciously.
Yeah. Do you want to say something, Tracy, about life scripts and how that fits into TA?
So the life script is really that, what I was talking about in the beginning, of that decision that we take to survive our family of origin. So a life script can be something like a winner script, where we always think we are going to do well at stuff, and we do well at stuff. Or it could be something like an almost script, like you might hear people saying, oh, I nearly made it in that relationship, or I nearly got that job, or I nearly got this. And it's almost like they feel like they're falling at the last hurdle. And when you look at a script like that, for example, it might be that someone's engaging in some self-sabotage because they might not think that they're deserving of getting what they perceive to be the success in their life. So by understanding our life script, and there's lots of different types of life script that Byrne refers to. There could be the always and never, essentially, like I never do this, I always do that, or I can't do this. It's like an incapability type script that we can also have as well. And I think beyond Byrne's, you'll hear just generally people's life scripts of the way that they interpret the world, of the patterns of what happens to them all the time. You hear, again, repetitive language that says, I can never do this, or it's always gone wrong for me, or I go to the doctors and they never listen to me. It's those kind of scripts and narratives that we think, how we think the world and others are going to respond to us, and then the kind of fate that we assume that we're going to have because of that. So once we know someone's life script, we then are sort of unpicking it by looking at ego states, by mapping egograms, and by looking at those injunctions that we might have had in early life, and understanding how the person is replaying those scripts in the way that they're having these interactions and the games that they're playing with people in order to try and get a different outcome. So by that, I mean, if you have a child whose needs were not met, for example, if we stick with the example we had at the beginning, if a child's crying and they're not being nurtured and someone's not responding to them, they never basically have that attunement. They never have that responding to their tears. So any game that they play, so psychological, unconscious, ulterior interactions that they're having, will be trying to get their upset responded to in a nurturing way. And that will repeat itself through things that they do over and over again, because they're looking for the payoff of actually getting their needs met. But actually what they're getting the payoff of is they're responding in a way that's maybe reactive. So therefore somebody might be stepping back from them instead of stepping towards them. So it's then responding to their and reinforcing the life script of, well, nobody ever meets my needs. So it's helping people to map the part they play unconsciously into recreating their early life experience in all of their future relationships or interactions with the world, themselves and others.
We could talk all day on TA. There's a reason, I guess, it took 4 years to train in it. Yeah. But do you want to just think about drivers? Because these are fascinating. Yes. And after you've got those ego states, you then go on to thinking about drivers and how they play out.
Yeah, the drivers we have are, again, they're linked to this life script and these decisions that we make. So the drivers are kind of ways we've decided to be in the world. So there's something called a try hard driver, where somebody might decide, oh, only if I try a bit harder, people will meet my needs. Or there's a be perfect driver, which is, if I get everything right all the time, then people will love me, people will meet my needs. Or there could be a be stronger driver, which is linked to what we're saying about if a child's emotions are suppressed, often they'll be quite self-sufficient, they'll want to get on with things themselves, they'll feel they have to cope, they don't necessarily seek help so much. Those kind of patterns will play out. So that might map on to what we might see as more of an avoidant attachment pattern. And then there might be please others driver. So again, where we've maybe learnt in childhood that we need to put other people's needs first, and we keep doing that in these repetitive patterns. And what will happen is we'll do these things unconsciously, we'll experience great frustration because we're not getting our needs met, but we'll still be driven to do these same patterns. It's almost like a perseveration where we just keep doing the same thing over and over again, but we're not getting any different results. And it's because we're often operating from either child or parent ego state, which isn't ourself. So we're not connected with who we are in the here and now. And we're just not able to think logically and look at ourselves and think, why are we not getting the results that we want? We're really trying to, but it's just not receiving the right response.
And I'm guessing that some drivers might be more prevalent in certain settings. So, for example, in work and relationship to colleagues, there might be a different driver at play there to, say, at home with a partner. I guess it depends on the quality of the attachment or the type of interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. We all have preferred drivers, but we can all operate from all of them as well. So there will be certain scenarios and environments that will trigger them more than others. So, for example, if you had a be strong driver, you might at work always think, I've got to go to work even if I'm sick, I can't have a day off, I can't possibly do that, because you don't feel safe maybe with the people that you work with to say I'm struggling. But you might have started to build a more secure attachment with a partner because of maybe what they have brought to the dynamic. So you might be starting to be able to go home to your partner and say, actually, I am struggling, but I don't quite know what to do with it. So there can be some sort of changes as well that we see. So there can be reparative relationships that might start to take us out of our driver experiences if we can have different experiences with people that can contain our emotions and our experiences in different ways.
Yeah. Just before we finish, Tracy, I'd love to just briefly talk about the drama triangle, because I think this is something that I find comes up in sessions. Clients have come being quite familiar or referencing it themselves, because I think it's quite accessible and people can understand. And they quite like this idea of roles that they're entering. So is the drama triangle a direct offshoot of TA? And Do you mind just explaining a little bit about it?
Yeah. I think there's differences of opinion as to whether it is a part of TA or not, but it is used within TA. So Stephen Cartman was the chap that actually created the drama triangle. But what it does map onto is Burns games that people play. So it's the ulterior transactions that we're having that are below the surface. So what we've been talking about when there might be an ego state communication that isn't really what it looks like it is. So it's an ulterior transaction with an underlying meaning. So somebody can take a victim position where they feel that they've been wronged. They can take a persecutor position where they feel that they need to kind of argue back and say to somebody that they are wrong. Or they can take a rescuer position where they're trying to save everything and make everything right in some way and be a moderator to whatever conflict or discussion is happening. And we can all operate through all of these positions on the triangle. And in an interaction with someone, we might have a favoured one, but at some level we will all move through these if a strategy that we're using to interact isn't quite working. So somebody might, for example, always want to sort everyone else's problems out. So if they've had a childhood, for example, where they've maybe had to look after other siblings or they've had to hold their emotions and deal with a parent's emotions, they might favour the rescuer position on the triangle where they want to sort everyone's problems out. Whereas if someone's had quite a strong critical parent where they've been told that the world is wrong and everything's not okay and mum's just done something wrong again and you've not done that right and this is the way it should be done, they may take a persecutor position more easily because that's the norm, that's the familiar life script position for them. And similarly with victim, if they've always been somebody that's never had needs met but maybe has not even asked for them, or when they have asked for them they've been shouted down, they might take a position where they just feel more helpless in what's happening. We've all got a bit of everything in us, but we will favour certain positions. And mapping this can help people to understand when they're not communicating directly. So a bit similar to the conversation we were talking about earlier, if someone's saying, you're never home on time, you're never here for me, the you never is victim-y because the person's emotionally feeling that their needs have been unmet, but it's moving into persecutor because it's saying you. So it's being a bit parental and almost going, you never do this, and it's taking someone out. So it's a little bit of both. And what can happen with a couple is they might start to escalate a little bit, but then one of them will back down and then start to maybe distract or appease it in some way to make it all go away and then never talk about it again until the pattern repeats itself the next week.
Or until they start then feeling annoyed that they appease them, and so then they move into persecutor again.
Yeah.
You know, I do find the drama triangle a really helpful visual way of helping clients to understand we all take roles and we can move through them. Sometimes within a conversation or a escalated conversation, you can move through it multiple times. It does take somebody to take that adult position to actually create the exit where you can say, right, let's talk about this later when we've calmed down a bit, or to be able to hear the need without being reactive.
Yeah, so if we stick with that example again, you know, if somebody says, oh, you never hear for me, you're always home late, it's about someone literally trying to validate those emotions and be adult and say, look, you're really upset with me right now, I can hear it, I know it's been frustrating for you that I've been home late, it's hard for me too, or, you know, what can we do to try and help you when that happens again, can I do anything differently? It's about sticking with that person's need and tracking that to be attuned to them in that moment. And then once they are calm and validated, it's also about the other person then being able to state what they need in that interaction as well.
Well, we are at time, Tracy, but this is such a fascinating area, and I think there is lots more to be learned. So if people are wanting more information, where would you suggest people go if they were thinking, oh, that sounds interesting, I'd like to do some training in that? Where's the best place to access that?
So I did my training at Wilden College in Crowborough, and they still run what's called a TA 101 course, which is a foundation course with topics that you might want to do that would be really interesting to do if you wanted to then go on to train in TA. They're not running the full training now, but there are other services that do. The Burn Institute is one that you can do in the UK as well that does the full training. I do a course, a day's course, on helping clinicians to use TA approaches in whatever process that they use for therapy and whatever their approach is. So it's giving you mapping all of these techniques and giving you day-to-day techniques that you can then filter into your own approaches that I do as a day's course, which is advertised on my site that I think you'll have the information for.
Yeah, and, so I'll put all relevant information in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time and your expertise. I definitely am thinking, you know, my knowledge is so limited and I'd love to have the confidence to explain this to clients, but we have to have that first ourselves, you know, so.
Yeah, my course takes you through that because it's really simple, but there's still a lot. So it's understanding your own way of saying all of it, really.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mastering Therapy. All of the resources mentioned are available in the show notes. If you're interested in getting more information on what's been covered this season, you can sign up to our mailing list or visit the website masteringtherapy.com. If you've listened to this and you've thought of someone you think would be great to interview on the podcast, submit a recommendation on the website. I'd love to hear from you. The Mastering Therapy podcast and the information provided by me and my guests is solely intended for qualified professionals.